Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. October baseball is upon us. Hearts are high in Detroit, Phoenix, and Tampa, among other places. Oh, and in Milwaukee.
I think in 2008, most of the guys on the team and most of the people around town were thinking, it's just good to be there. But I think most anybody would tell you now that the Brewers aren't just happy to be there anymore. They expect to win.
Ahead on Only a Game, we toast the Brewers and acknowledge the Diamondbacks as well. Also coming up, it's been a great autumn for NFL quarterbacks so far, but Norm Van Brocklin's 60-year-old passing record still stands. We'll examine that circumstance, and we'll relish an over or two of cricket. Did I get that right? Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Tampa Bay Rays gave the ball to a rookie pitcher last night in the opening game of their American League Division Series against the Texas Rangers. It turned out to be a dandy decision. Matt Moore, whose major league record had been 1-0, is now 2-0. He pitched 7 scoreless innings, giving up just 2 hits, and the Rays won the game 9-0. No pitcher with only 1 major league start on his resume had previously started a postseason opener. Moore got help from Johnny Damon, who hit a home run, and Kelly Schopak, who homered twice. The Rangers will try to even the series at 1 game apiece when the two teams play again tonight in Texas. Meanwhile, in New York, the Yankees and the Tigers each scored 1 run, and then it rained. The game was suspended during the second inning. The two teams are scheduled to pick up where they left off this evening, though the forecast is for more rain in New York. The National League Division Series will open in Philadelphia this evening, where the wild-card winning St. Louis Cardinals will be visiting the Phillies. In the other NLDS game this afternoon, the Milwaukee Brewers will host the Arizona Diamondbacks. The Brewers last appeared in the World Series in 1982 when they were in the American League's Eastern Division. Now they are champs of the NL Central, and their fans are optimistic that the glory won't end there. From Milwaukee Public Radio, Mitch Teich has this story.
It takes a dedicated fan to drive 420 miles to watch a mediocre baseball team. Yet that's exactly what Terry O'Rourke has been doing nearly every year for the past 5 decades. O'Rourke lives in Carroll, Iowa, not far from the Nebraska border, but he's been a diehard fan first of the Milwaukee Braves, then the Milwaukee Brewers, dying a little almost every year since 1982. But outside Miller Park this week, O'Rourke thinks this edition compares favorably to its predecessor.
Well, I think that we have a chance to go all the way. I think our pitching is better. I think we'd have won in 82 if our fingers wouldn't have been hurt. But that's 29 years ago, so what do you do about it? You know? I think this is as good a chance as any as we got to go.
O'Rourke might be the only one making the Carroll to Milwaukee commute, but he's not the only one who thinks the Brew Crew could last deep into the playoffs.
I feel great going into the playoffs with this team.
Ron Renicki is the Brewers' manager.
Because I don't care how good these other teams are, when you get in the playoffs, you have a special group of guys that when they put things together, you can go all the way.
This is Renicki's first year at the helm. In fact, it's his first year managing any major league team. But this is a team that has had a lot of firsts this year, from its single-season wins record to a new team attendance record. Renicki says it's a good algorithm.
Good baseball team, good baseball town. Yeah, I think if you put those two combinations, that's where we are.
Renicki was given a lot to work with. A year ago, the debate in Milwaukee was whether the team should trade first baseman Prince Fielder going into the last year of his contract. Instead, general manager Doug Melvin not only hung on to Fielder, but traded for Zach Greinke, the Royals' former Cy Young winner, and Sean Markham, one of Toronto's leading pitchers. Mid-season, he added 4-time All-Star reliever Frankie Rodriguez. Melvin says he felt a responsibility to the city that has supported his team.
You know, winning, you go out and play the game as hard as you can, and you have a chance to win, and that's what you ask for, and get a talented team. But I think we've shown that by going out and acquiring the players we've had and signing some of Ryan Braun to a long-term contract, and Gallardo and Weeks and Hart and that. So we've shown that responsibility.
Left fielder Ryan Braun is in the running for MVP. Pitcher Yovani Gallardo finished the year at 17-10. Right fielder Corey Hart slugged 26 homers, and second baseman Ricky Weeks finished with 20, even though he missed a month with an ankle injury. Speaking on Fox Sports Wisconsin when the Brewers clinched the NL Central, Weeks reflected on when he knew this team had a chance.
Spring training. I think the cockiness, the confidence came in, I think, a little bit. And that's where you got to be like that, to win games like that. So the pitching came in, the defense played pretty well this year, and on the offense, of course, was there. So I think for the most part, all the phases came into play, and we just had fun today.
Weeks was around for the Brewers' most recent playoff run in 2008 when they won the NL Wild Card. That was the year they rented CC Sabathia. But their playoff run was so tenuous that they actually fired the manager in late September and found themselves swept in the first round. The Brewers and baseball observers say this year will be different. Michael Hunt is a sports columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
I think in 2008, most of the guys on the team and most of the people around town were thinking, you know, it's been a long, long time since they've been in the playoffs, and it's just good to be there. But I think most anybody would tell you now that the Brewers aren't just happy to be there anymore. They expect to win.
It's those expectations that have packed Miller Park all year long. Almost 3.1 million fans showed up in the smallest market in baseball. But outside Miller Park, the scene is oddly quiet under the haze from grilling bratwurst. A kind of nervous energy masks the unusual feeling of confidence surrounding Milwaukee baseball this October. A larger-than-life statue of Robin Yount, a reminder of the last best hope for the Brewers, looms over Terry O'Rourke. He's philosophical about the ups and downs of his love for the Brewers.
My wife will attest this has been a long year for watching them on TV. I've been expecting us to win, and when they kind of had their slumps, I get a little upset. But she thinks I own the team. But I said, well, I've put enough blood and sweat and tears in them for, since 1970, that maybe I do own part of them a little bit.
O'Rourke says he expects the Brewers to win the World Series this year, and when they do, he'll be watching from his personal owner's box back in Carroll, Iowa. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Milwaukee.
The Brewers' opponent in the NLDS, the Arizona Diamondbacks, finished at the bottom of the National League West last year, and the year before that as well, but this year they decided to win the division, thereby making the playoffs for the first time since 2007. Joining me from Milwaukee to discuss how the Diamondbacks slithered to the top is Nick Pecoro, who covers the team for the Arizona Republic. Nick, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's go to spring training for a second. Why not begin at the beginning? The Diamondbacks had finished last the previous year. Were there any signs that they were ready to go from 69 wins to 94 wins?
No. In fact, I think that most people that watched the team play in spring training thought it was going to go the other way, that they might actually be worse than they were last year. Looking back at it, I think Kirk Gibson was probably the only person, maybe the only person in the world, that could legitimately say that he believed that this team was going to win. I really don't think that there were a whole lot of other believers even within the organization.
Well, let's go right to talking about the manager then. Gibson took over the team midway through last season. Does he deserve a lot of the credit for the turnaround?
I think so, sure. I think there's a lot of guys that are outperforming expectations, and a lot of times you have to give the manager credit for that. I think the biggest thing is he's kind of changed this mindset and this culture around this team. Winning is now kind of expected, and I think that coming off of a couple of really lousy seasons, that maybe wasn't the case. The way that those Manager of the Year awards go, I think that wherever there's the biggest difference between, you know, reality and expectations, that guy usually gets the award. So I'm pretty sure Kirk Gibson is going to be the landslide winner this year in the National League.
Gibson, of course, has some of the very best kind of World Series experience. Clutch walk-off home run for the Dodgers in 1988, and he had won a World Series while playing in Detroit back in 84. Does that kind of experience help inexperienced players to deal with the postseason pressure?
I don't know. I think that postseason experience is a really interesting thing. I mean, I think there probably is something to having been there and gone through those emotions before, but then you look back at some teams, I guess the 03 Marlins are one that jump out to me as a team that didn't have very much experience and it didn't seem to matter. Kirk Gibson does talk about his past a lot, and even as recently as a couple of weeks ago, they had a scouting meeting with all of their scouts before they went out and started talking about, you know, postseason work. And he reminded all of those scouts that it was a scouting report from one of those guys with the Dodgers, Mel Didier, that, you know, had him looking for a 3-2 slider from Dennis Eckersley before he hit that home run. So, you know, I think he's aware that, you know, all those little details matter, and he reminds everyone of you know, the things that he accomplished in his career.
Ian Kennedy will start for Arizona in Game 1 tonight. He joined the Diamondbacks last season after parts of a few seasons in the big leagues with the Yankees. But how did he go from 9-10 in 2010 to 21-4 this year?
Well, I don't think that there's a whole lot different with Ian Kennedy from this year to last year. The one thing that jumps to mind for me is last year he would have days where he wasn't commanding his fastball very well and he would get hit around. He wouldn't find a way to overcome that. This year, there's days when he's clearly struggling and you know, pitching deep into counts and having trouble putting guys away. But for whatever reason this year, he seems to be able to last through six or seven innings even on those days. The record and that sort of thing can be kind of misleading, especially in his past. I mean, he didn't get a very big opportunity when he was with the Yankees. And, you know, that's the way it works in New York. You don't have a very long leash a lot of the time if you're a young player.
Tell us about some other key Arizona players that we should keep an eye on in this series.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in how their 3-4 hitters end up doing. Justin Upton hits third, and he's kind of been the catalyst of the offense all season. He's going to end up getting some MVP votes. I don't think he's going to win the award, but he'll be up there. And I wonder whether teams are going to pitch to him and how the Brewers are going to handle him. If they wind up pitching around him, that's going to make Miguel Montero, the cleanup hitter, an even bigger part. The last 5 weeks, Montero's been swinging, a red-hot bat, and I wonder, are teams going to be more willing to challenge Upton because of that, or are they still going to say, this guy's a little too good for us, let's take our chances with Montero? I think that could end up being a real key in this series.
Milwaukee is coming off their best regular season in franchise history. Game one tonight. How do you think the two teams match up?
I think they're actually really even. I think the Brewers probably have the edge. I think they have a little bit better lineup, maybe a little bit deeper starting pitching. They both have very good bullpens. I really like the way that this series matches up on paper. I think the Diamondbacks have a little bit of an edge defensively. The Diamondbacks have been a team that, you know, as we talked about, nobody really believed in them, and they've been proving people wrong all year. I just looked on ESPN.com, and 20 of the 22 people who made predictions for their website had the Brewers winning this series. So I'm sure that's something the Diamondbacks are going to use as motivation.
You sound a little reluctant to pick a winner in this series. I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. Who advances?
I've been picking against the Diamondbacks all season, and they've been proving me wrong all season, so I'll stick with it. I look at it, and I see some slight edges for the Brewers. I'll go with them winning in, you know, probably four or five games.
Nick Pecoro covers the Diamondbacks for the Arizona Republic, and he joined me from Milwaukee. Nick, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me. We're all Diamondback fans. Go Backs, go! So stomp your feet and clap your hands. Open up the box so we can all get a tan. We're the wildest darn fans east of Disneyland. We're all Diamondback fans. Oh, yeah. Come on. Yeah, I'm a Diamondback fan. Oh, you better know it, Jack.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Moms who complain that their kids won't clean up their rooms have been characterized as nags. They've also been characterized as dreamers. But until this week, none of those moms has been responsible for vacating 3 wins accomplished by a high school football team. How can 2 boys mess up their room as badly as they do when they're only here Saturday and Sunday? Wrote the mother of 2 Perry County, Tennessee high school players on her Facebook page. Someone who saw that post figured out that those players didn't live in the district. And presto, the 3 games their team had won disappeared. The moral? Maybe something about the perils of Facebook. Or maybe it's just that kids ought to pick up their rooms. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an in-depth look at the impact of concussions. But first, Cam Newton is accustomed to making headlines. While a quarterback at Auburn, he led the Tigers to a national championship, won a Heisman Trophy, and shared the spotlight with his father during a scandal when the latter was accused of shopping Newton's services in a pay-for-play scheme. Now with the NFL's Carolina Panthers, Newton is disproving the conventional wisdom about rookie quarterbacks. Joining me to discuss what some are calling Cam Mania is Scott Fowler, a sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer. Scott, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
In three games, Cam Newton has more than 1,000 yards passing. He's thrown four touchdowns, rushed for two more. So much for concerns about putting him in there before he's ready, right?
Yeah, exactly. They were 2-14 last season, the worst team in the NFL, and I think they just kind of decided, hey, let's give this guy a shot. They've got a rookie head coach here, Ron Rivera, and he has just thrown him to what you would think would be the Wolves, but in fact, Cam turns out to be something of a wolf himself. He can play with any of these guys. And as you mentioned, Cam Mania. I tell you, Charlotte and the Carolinas is in the full-fledged grip of it.
His statistics, 400 yards passing in each of the first two games, unfortunately also four interceptions in those games, and Carolina lost them both, but they won on Sunday when Newton had just 158 yards passing and didn't turn the ball over against Jacksonville. Which Cam Newton do you expect to see more of as the season goes on?
Well, I think we'll probably see a combination of the two. Last Sunday, when they won that game, there was a near biblical rainstorm here in Charlotte. It was a deluge. And in all of that, Cam Newton never fumbled, never threw an interception, handled the ball well, and obviously that would have brought down the passing yardage significantly. One of the raps on him was that he might be an inaccurate quarterback, that at Auburn his receivers were all open by 5 yards because the whole team was such good athletes. But he has managed to throw the ball very accurately in these first three games, other than, as you mentioned, the interceptions. He's made a couple of silly rookie mistakes, but in general has been far better than expected.
During his time at Auburn, Newton was known as much for his running as for his passing. He's got 98 yards on the ground so far this year. This makes him Carolina's leading rusher. Probably not a great sign in terms of a balanced attack.
You're very right. It is not a good sign, and in fact, Newton is a big guy and is as big as most tight ends, bigger than most linebackers, but he's not as big as everybody out there, and they're all coming after him. I hope he will mostly stay in the pocket and be a passer who runs, but sort of like a Ben Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh, where he runs mainly to just extend a play. He doesn't run to try to gain yardage.
As you said, the Panthers have not been successful lately. They were 2-14 last year, and it usually takes more than one player to turn that around. Where do you expect Carolina to wind up with Newton under center?
Well, this year, Bill, honestly, I predicted, I think, before the season, 7-9. I think I might have said 6-10, and it may not even be quite that good. And you know how the NFL is. I mean, Buffalo and Detroit this year are the surprise teams early, and every year somebody pops up. I don't think this will be the Panthers' year to do that. However, I wouldn't be surprised if they did in 2012.
Scott Fowler is a sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer. Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's not exactly breaking news that the NFL is a quarterbacks league. It's possible to win with an average guy under center, but it's a lot easier when your signal caller is among the elite. Despite the evolution of the quarterback position, the NFL's single-game passing record has endured. Wednesday marked the 60th anniversary of Norm Van Brocklin's 554-yard performance for the Los Angeles Rams. Joining me now is ProFootballReference.com blog writer Chase Stewart. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
Last fall, you wrote about why Norm Van Brocklin's mark had survived the careers of big yardage passers like Dan Marino, Dan Fouts, Warren Moon, Peyton Manning, Drew Brees. We tend to associate big passing totals with the modern game, but you point out that quarterbacks in the 40s and 50s like to air it out too.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think a lot of younger fans today associate the older days of football with the 70s. And there's no doubt that the 1970s were basically football's version of the dead ball period. quarterbacks didn't throw very effectively. They didn't throw very often. The 40s and 50s had a lot of big passing games and a lot of big receiving games.
Van Brocklin's Rams were very good. Their opponent on September 28, 1951, was the New York Yanks, and they were very bad. How much did the matchup contribute to Van Brocklin's feat?
Not to take anything away from Van Brocklin, who's a Hall of Famer, but the New York Yanks were not a very good team. They're, you know, maybe they're a little bit better than a semi-pro team today, but I think the difference between the 32nd team today and the average team in the league would be much smaller than the Yanks of those days versus the average team in the early 50s.
There has been a lot of talk about the statistics New England's Tom Brady and Carolina rookie quarterback Cam Newton put up in the first three games of the current season, enormous passing statistics. Some people point to the fact that the time off during the lockout perhaps lulled defenses to sleep. Do you buy that argument?
I will say that passing numbers, they are higher than normal. Even accounting for the fact that passing numbers are usually higher in September before the weather changes, things are out of whack this year. And even though they've been rising steadily the past few years, 2011 does seem to be a departure. So maybe it's the lockout. I guess it could also just be a lot of great quarterbacks are playing really well right now and none of them are hurt.
Of course, another development is the National Football League has made some rule changes this year that many people feel favor the offense. Tell us how you think these factor into some of those 400 and 500-yard passing games we've seen.
From a historical perspective, in 1978, there were rule changes on how linemen could block and what cornerbacks could do. That really sparked the first change in passing numbers. I think if you look, though, the big thing is passing is just much more of an attractive option than it used to be. The sack rates and interception rates have really plummeted throughout all of football history. That's one of the examples where it actually is a pretty linear history, where in the 50s and 40s, even when there was significant passing numbers, interception rates and sack rates were high. Now there's just not a whole lot of downside to passing, and this may be the new NFL.
All right, Chase, using some proprietary technology that I can't reveal on the air, during this next answer, we're going to pipe your voice into the speaker inside the helmet of every quarterback in the National Football League. So what advice would you give them about trying to knock Norm Van Brocklin off in the single-game passing yardage department?
Well, first, you can't be afraid to run up the score. it wouldn't hurt if you could gain a bunch of yards and then maybe throw an interception in the end zone. It won't look as bad, the running up the score. You know, you want to gain yards but not score points.
Uh-huh.
You need to have your defense not on the field very often, and you need to have a lot of big plays. So it'll break eventually just because there are so many games played and so many good quarterbacks. But it's lasted this long, so you can't say it's going to definitely break anytime soon.
Chase Stewart writes for ProFootballReference.com. You can link to his article, Why is Norm Van Brocklin Still a Record Holder? At our website, onlyagame.org. Chase, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's been great. I always love talking football. You guys have a good day out there.
The concussion crisis, subtitled Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic, begins with the story of a young man with whom, quote, concussions caught up before he could play a single down of college football. Dave Showalter, the subject of that story, shook off concussions as a child and throughout his high school football career, but they eventually derailed his life. Linda Carroll and David Rossner are the co-authors of The Concussion Crisis, and Linda Carroll joins me now from Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi.
Linda, tell us more about Dave Showalter and why you chose to begin your book with his story.
Dave Showalter, you know, played football from the time he was like a little kid. I mean, he and his brothers used to play knee football on the floor of their mother's, you know, their parents' house. And he got into tackle football pretty early in life, and it was really important to him. And even though he was suffering concussions and sometimes experiencing fairly significant symptoms, he kept playing. When he got to college, you know, he kept having concussions, and ultimately he had such bad symptoms that he couldn't do his classwork. He would look at his notebooks and start reading the notes that he'd taken in class, and he wouldn't even remember that he'd been in the class. So he went to a neuropsychologist who told him that the number of concussions he had was still was pretty much unknown, but it was clear that they'd had some pretty serious effect on his brain and that he might never completely recover from them. And she told him never to play football again. You know, he took time off and he started feeling better. He had no symptoms and he went back to play. And then his academic career went totally down the drain because, you know, he failed classes and he couldn't keep up and he dropped out of school. And when, you know, by the time we met him, he was living in a tiny apartment and supporting himself by delivering bagels. I mean, and he's a really smart guy. You know, his story best showed what can happen to someone when concussions aren't taken seriously.
In the chapter titled Through the Cracks, you write about the work of a psychologist named Wayne Gordon, who believes that traumatic brain injuries can lead to learning disabilities. What is the evidence for that connection?
A lot of the kids who have problems learning tended to have brain traumas somewhere in their history. Wayne Gordon actually went into the schools in New York City and studied kids and interviewed them and their parents to find out what their history was. And kids with learning disabilities often had some kind of brain trauma, whether it was a concussion or a more severe injury.
You conclude at one point that the publicity surrounding NFL players who've been sidelined with concussions will make younger athletes and the parents of those athletes more aware of head injuries and the consequences. But isn't there a danger that youngsters will argue, hey, Ben Roethlisberger keeps coming back after multiple concussions, why shouldn't I?
I think the hope is that the example is maybe you can come back after concussions, only if you have them diagnosed and managed properly. I mean, the example of Ben Roethlisberger is that, yes, he has concussions and, yes, he comes back, but he goes to the concussion clinic, he gets tested after each concussion, and he doesn't get to go back to play until his symptoms have resolved. I mean, one thing we do know today is that if you have a concussion and you don't manage it, if you just keep playing, the results are so much more dire than if you took time off and let your brain recover before you went back and possibly sustained another concussion.
A lot of the discussion of concussions and the problems they've caused athletes later in life has focused on men playing football or hockey, but you found that girls and women are especially vulnerable to concussions, in part because they assume they won't get them. Why would they assume that?
It's not just the girls, you know, it's the parents and the coaches. And, you know, everybody just assumes that girls don't play as hard as boys do. And so the assumption, you know, what follows from that is that, you know, girls aren't going to be hitting hard enough to get concussions. You know, whereas there are plenty of girls out there who play every bit as hard as the boys do.
I guess I'm not surprised at the general assumption that girls don't play as hard as boys do, but I'm very surprised that that assumption is apparent in the girls themselves, the female athletes.
You know, we grow up thinking we're just not as aggressive as the boys. And, you know, we feel like, you know, second-class athletic citizens. I think sometimes girls even play harder because they feel like, you know, everyone views them as not playing as hard as boys.
Dr. Douglas Smith argued in the Journal of Neuroscience 2 years ago that, as you write, quote, concussions could cause permanent changes in neurons in the brain, permanent changes, especially second concussions when the brain hasn't fully recovered from the first one. Do you think that that belief has been accepted in the athletic community and beyond?
I think it will perhaps someday be accepted, but people don't want to believe it because they don't want to change the way they play their games. They like the games the way they are, and it's preferable, if you like the games the way they are, to dismiss the science.
We've spoken about concussions suffered by athletes, but lots of men serving in Iraq and Afghanistan have also been victims of traumatic brain injury. What have the doctors and scientists learned from working with soldiers who've come back from service there?
You know, even though there's a lot of brain injury going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you really saw people studying concussions was on the playing field, because there were so many concussions happening all along, And now what's happened is that the military has kind of turned to the model that's been developed in the sports arena to diagnose and manage concussions and brain injuries. Maybe not, you know, the severe brain injuries are something that I think the military had more experience dealing with, but everything in between severe and so-called mild brain injuries, you were seeing more in the sports arena.
The subtitle of your book is Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic. What leads you to characterize the epidemic of concussions and brain injuries as still silent in 2011? Because it seems to me that it's gotten a fair amount of publicity.
People still dismiss, you know, what happens to them personally. You know, I mean, you watch the football players and the hockey players and you see them have these dramatic concussions and you see them missing games. But that doesn't necessarily mean you've taken that to apply to yourself. You know, you have a car accident and, you know, you get rattled, but you can walk away from the car accident. You figure you're okay. There's probably a lot of people out there who are suffering from the after effects of some kind of brain injury, you know, whether it's a concussion or something more severe, who don't know that the changes in their lives were caused by that brain injury. You know, the symptoms can be fairly subtle, but life-changing. You know, your memory isn't the same. You know, your concentration's not what it used to be. You can't organize stuff. But those things can be subtle enough that you don't really attribute it. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's kind of a silent epidemic, is because people don't always attribute what's happened to them to the injury they had to their brain.
With David Rossner, Linda Carroll wrote The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and Linda Carroll joined me from Philadelphia. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Among the most successful surfers at a competition held in Huntington Beach, California last weekend was Abby Huey, whose ride covered 60 meters or 197 feet. That may not sound like much of a ride, but Abby is an Australian Kelpie dog, and no dog had ever stayed that long on a moving surfboard, at least according to the people at Guinness World Records. Abby set the record during the Surf City Surf Dog competition at a venue called Dog Beach, where canines are free to run, dig, and of course surf without cumbersome leashes, although they do wear life jackets. I'm sure you're relieved to hear that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, by Jiminy, we'll have some cricket. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
All right. Has there been a more topsy-turvy night of baseball than Wednesday night, during which, for those who weren't watching, the American League's wild card was determined when the Tampa Bay Rays erased a 7-run deficit against the Yankees, and then some other team blew their lead against the Orioles with two out in the bottom of the ninth?
A more topsy-turvy day? Well, not since the Reds and the White Sox teed it up in the 19 series, my friend.
And that was only one
and they were
game.
And they were trying to lose. What's been obscured by everything a little bit is how completely endearing the Tampa Bay Rays are. How do you possibly not root for this team at this point?
An excellent
the
question.
The one thing I didn't see coming was that they would fall behind 7-0 and come back to win. I mean, if you just told me that the Rays were going to win and the Red Sox were going to lose, I'd have believed you. But the idea that the Red Sox have a lead, go into a rain delay, and here come as soon Has anybody on that Red Sox bench discovered that Tampa had made a game against about it again? It was all over.
Wednesday night's drama in the American League led to the termination of Boston manager Terry Francona, or at least that was part of it. He had led the Red Sox to World Series titles in 2004 and again in 2007. What do you think? Was Francona to blame for the unprecedented collapse?
No, he was handed a locker room full of jerks by his management, and it finally overwhelmed him at the end of the year. I'm glad he's leaving. I think his health would have been endangered if he stayed with this bunch for another year. He will get a job at managing a baseball team next year and do very well at it.
The National League had its own excitement this week with a wild card coming down to the final game of the regular season. The St. Louis Cardinals edged Atlanta for that slot. The Cards open their divisional series with the Phillies in Philadelphia tonight. I would ask, who do you like? But Philadelphia's got to be the answer, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have some lovely parting gifts for the Cardinals. It's very nice if they battled their way into the wild card spot. I don't think they're going to be around very long.
Meanwhile, your Milwaukee Brewers.
Ah, now we're talking.
Host Arizona tonight. Beers, snakes, things of that nature. Sounds exciting.
Bratwurst, my friend. Hey, listen, the spirit of Pedro Garcia is upon me again. What can I tell you? I am on the Brewer bandwagon.
Once you've been there, it never goes away.
That's right. Even though it's not County Stadium anymore.
No.
With the wonderful tin bleachers, it's fine by me.
You've got in front of you, as we speak, the schedule for tomorrow's NFL games, assuming that you will not be in one of those taverns with 60 television sets featuring a dozen games simultaneously. Which of these matchups will you be watching?
Well, I won't be watching the Vikings and the Chiefs try to prove that one of them can win an NFL game sometime before the end of the season. I can tell you that. The Patriots at the Raiders is an interesting game because people seem to think the Raiders are a much better team than they have been in the past, and the Patriots are, you know, coming off just a staggering loss in Buffalo. And I'm a little bit intrigued by the Steelers and the Texans because I haven't gotten a good handle on the Steelers yet, and the Texans are playing very well.
Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton by Jeff Perlman will be available in bookstores next week, but excerpts have already been released. The legendary Bears running back who died in 1999 apparently earned the nickname Sweetness in various ways. His former coach, Mike Ditka, is not happy about the revelations in the book. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Ditka says that, well, first of all, Ditka said he'd spit on the author, which we can consider beneath contempt. But he said the book serves no purpose when, in fact, it actually does. According to the book, he used all kinds of pain pills and liquids and Tylenol and Vicodin and even nitrous oxide to deal with the injuries to his body that came as a part of playing professional football. And the more stories we have about that, especially regarding beloved players, the better off football will be because it will try to resolve these issues. But ultimately, Bill, there is no way to have a functioning human body and play professional football for any length of time. It's not possible.
During an interview conducted in Indianapolis on Wednesday, NCAA President Mark Emmert said that his organization, and I'm quoting now, is not the NFL or the NBA because the NCAA is not a business. So, it's a hobby that gets paid $10 billion.
That guy's the funniest guy in sports, I swear to God.
$10 billion.
I've been to the Final Four. I've spent $40 for the sweatshirt, okay?
Did you notice that the always festive parade of the Zambonis had wended its way through town this week? Because whether or not you did, the National Hockey League season begins next week. So I wonder if you'd like to offer us a prediction or two.
I have one prediction to make about the National Hockey League. That is, if it doesn't crack itself out of being a niche sport this year with no NBA, it never will. As for the team, I think this is the year that Alexander Ovechkin and the Washington Capitals finally live up to it. So I'm picking them.
We've spoken about how hockey's preseason has seen the league penalize players for headhunting, Charlie. The preseason has also seen some dumb and disgraceful fan behavior, at least in Ontario.
Yeah, a guy named Chris Morehouse threw a banana at Wayne Simmons of the Flyers, who happens to be a black player. And, of course, Chris Morehouse's lawyer said he was only caught up in the drama of a tense game, a tense preseason game. And he threw the banana at Flyers in the hopes of preventing the winning goal. Okay, throwing anything at another player so he doesn't score the winning goal in an exhibition season means not only should you be banned from NHL arenas, you should spend the rest of your life in a rubber truck, okay? We continue. He also says that he had no idea that throwing a banana at a black man could be seen as racist. This guy should not be allowed to cut his own meat or handle his own money.
The NBA lockout is still going on. The two sides have been at the bargaining table. Some say talks planned for this weekend are at the point of now or never in terms of salvaging a complete regular season. So are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I still think we're going to wind up with a 50-game NBA season, which will satisfy nobody, but they will at least get the playoffs in, which is where they make some money.
Charlie, the next time you're not feeling inspired about our weekly chat, here's my advice. On the way in, stop by a cemetery and just lie down for a while, because it gives you motivation just thinking about it, doesn't it?
This guy's a coach of a junior varsity team. Now, bear that in mind as we go on further. And they had lost a game, and they were coming back on the bus or whatever.
And where is this?
This is in upstate New York.
Okay.
And he pulls in Marcellus, New York, and he has the team pull over, has the bus pull over, and he has the players go into a cemetery and lie down among the graves while the coach talks to them about the importance of playing hard. When you're looking for more effort, a cemetery is not really a place where you're going to find examples of that. All of the people in cemeteries, most of them anyway, are dead. They're not trying too hard at anything but being dead. Now, the coach says that he was trying to use a scene from the movie Remember the Titans. And I happen to have seen the movie. Coach Denzel Washington is trying to inculcate solidarity among his black and white players, and he takes them to the battlefield at Gettysburg. He didn't take them there because it was a cemetery. He took them there because there was a story to be told about what the consequences of racial hatred can be, okay? Mm. That one made sense, okay? Mm. Bringing guys to sort of a random cemetery and having them lay down between the tombstones, that's just weird.
And finally,
Charlie, your kids to a factory.
And finally,
if there are any of those still around.
Charlie.
Yes, hello.
Barcelona has not lost a game in Spain's top soccer league this year. They have tied one, and maybe that's why the players felt that they needed an excuse. And boy, they've come up with a good one, haven't they?
Yeah, apparently Nike has given them new shirts, and they're made out of something called Dry Fit, which is composed of recycled plastic, ick, and apparently it holds the sweat in somehow.
Yick.
Yeah, double ick, more heavily than the old shirts
did.
It
causes you to tie.
And they're blaming this for their tie. I think they should all go to a cemetery and lay down between the tombstones and relax.
Where everybody is muertos.
Nobody is sweating.
Charlie Pierce is a contributing writer for Esquire magazine. He's also the author of Idiot America and various other books, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And I bet that he would do that even on a day when his shirt felt really heavy. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you're perplexed by Patsy Cline, flummoxed by Fugazi, or bamboozled by Bartok, Brubeck, or Booker T and the MGs, please visit onlyagame.org to learn more about the music you hear on Only a Game. Needham, Massachusetts, the town where my family and I have lived for more than 25 years, is currently celebrating its 300th anniversary. On Sunday, one of the events connected with that celebration drew me to the same field where my daughters used to play soccer pretty well and where I used to coach it badly. In the center of the field, half a dozen men were taping together several thin rectangular concrete slabs. One of the men, Raja Tumla, who came to the U.S. from India 13 years ago, explained that he and the other fellows were trying to render the soccer field temporarily fit for cricket.
The cricket pitch usually needs a 22 yards and 6 feet wide surface, which is hard. No grass, and it should be hard enough so that the ball pitches and bounces.
The efforts of Raja Tumla and his colleagues were earnest, but he wasn't promising success.
You can see, like, the ball is not bouncing as much as we like. We probably need more nails and fix it to the ground.
I'd seen film of cricket matches and even part of a live match once near London, so I understood that the fellow called the bowler needed a hard surface off which he could deliver the ball on the bounce to the fellow who would try to hit it. What I didn't understand immediately was why anybody needed to render this soccer field, which incidentally has always been known as Cricket Field, fit for cricket. For an explanation, I turned to Charlie Wright, the man responsible for the attempt at transformation. He began his explanation at the beginning.
Cricket predominantly being an English sport and invented in England in the 1600s. The early ancestors of Needham were all of English descent, and they brought the game. And they had other pitches in town, too, but this is the only one that's actually stayed and kept the name Cricket Field.
Cricket was so successfully transplanted that for a time, Needham Heights was known as the cricket capital of Massachusetts. Those days, as Charlie Wright acknowledged, are long gone, but no less worth recalling for that.
This is like rare. They never hear any fields called cricket anymore. Majority of the residents, the new residents in Needham, still think it's named after the insect.
Once Wright and his colleagues on the committee planning the commemoration of Needham's 300th birthday decided that a cricket match should be part of the fun, all they had to do was find two cricket teams. Wright discovered the existence of a cricket league operating in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and, well, here's how he introduced the two sides as they prepared to play Sunday afternoon.
One of the largest cricket clubs in the country, Boston Gymkhana in red.
Yeah.
And in blue, the New England Royals.
Which team bats first is customarily decided by a coin toss. And once a coin had been located, selectman Dan Matthews tossed it.
Heads it is.
Will Field.
Congratulations.
Will Field.
The New England Royals won. They will field first.
At that point, it seemed to me that in at least one respect, cricket must be similar to baseball. Sure, the former only has two bases, whereas the latter has four. And sure, in cricket, there seems to be no such thing as foul territory. And nobody in baseball is called left silly leg. But in both games, the team fielding first and hence batting last has an advantage. By the time Gymkhana and the Royals were set to begin play, a crowd of perhaps 100 people had gathered on the grass around the pitch. I asked Raja Tumla how many people a regular league game might draw.
Not much. If it's a good Sunday, we can count on like 30, 40 people. Not more than that.
So it's for love.
Yeah, it's for the love of the game. Yeah, absolutely.
So Sunday's game could boast a better-than-average turnout, at least by Gymkhana Club standards. But how much did the people on these sidelines know about what they were watching? If Needham resident Cliff Hayden was representative, not much.
No, I know nothing about the sport, so I'm just going to learn and watch and enjoy and see what it's like. I've read a few of these, you know, English novels, and so, you know, I sort of know the story of cricket a little bit, but I've never actually watched a game in action, so that'll be fun.
And Cliff Hayden was right. It was fun, albeit sometimes a little mysterious.
Batsman had stepped out of the crease, so the wicketkeeper tried to dislodge the bales before he came back, but didn't succeed.
I don't know a bale from a wicket, but even I could see from the scoreboard that this game had become hopelessly lopsided. I mentioned that unfortunate circumstance to one of the Gymkhana players who was helping the guy with a bullhorn to explain what was happening.
It's 24 to nothing.
Yes.
This is terrible. Is 24 yes. to nothing a big deal, or is this just...
No, it's a very good start. So we have our first loss, so you jinxed us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
That's four runs, straight drive, crosses the boundary on a bounce. A ball that crosses the boundary without bouncing is like a home run in baseball, would be six runs.
The bowling, batting, and wicket-keeping went on throughout the afternoon. Some cricket matches are designed to go on for days, and some end without a result. This one lasted a matter of hours, and the result would be close. Gymkhana 101, New England Royals 100. As the game was winding down, I asked Sai Yamada of the winning side whether all the Gymkhana players were from India.
Yes, almost. We have a couple of people from Australia, and most of them are from India. But last season, we had a guy from England. So both Australia and England are cricket-playing nations. But occasionally, we have some people from, you know, Caribbean, which is closer to West Indies. West Indies is, you know, another cricket-playing team. So those guys come in, they play pretty good cricket.
I wondered if there were no players in the league who didn't come from cricket-playing nations because prospective players born in the U.S. had too many other sports from which to choose.
Yeah, and also there's no business yet in cricket in this part of the country. You know, in India, there are like 2 billion people watching cricket, but here the audience is less, so sponsors are less, and the game has to become more popular in order to get there.
It was impossible to tell whether Sunday's contest resulted in any progress along that line, but the two teams put on a fine display of the game under circumstances that must have been challenging, a pitch they'd had to cobble together with tape and nails, and an audience that had very little idea of when to cheer. Still, it seemed safe to assume that Charlie Wright and the rest of the people who'd organized the match were probably pleased. On the occasion of the town's 300th birthday, they'd managed to arrange the recreation of a bit of Needham's history, even if it hadn't involved anybody who was English, and some number of the citizens who dropped by to watch probably understand now that Cricket Field wasn't named after an insect. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jillian Guybe. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. We had help from Hillary McQuilkin. This week, Doug and John did most of the work. To view my photographic exploration of the mysteries of cricket on Cricket Field and learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word comes from the sideline of that cricket match where the mother of a 3.5-month-old spectator named Timmy charted her son's future.
And Timmy is going to play cricket and rugby and Aussie rules and all of them.
Ah, just another traditional three-sport athlete. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.